Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening to everyone online. A few weeks ago, we discussed a few passages in the Tenzo Kyokan, or Instructions to the Tenzo, the Zen Cook. And it's found in this really wonderful compendium of some of Dogen's most well-known fascicles called Moon in a Dewdrop, Writings of Zen Master Dogen, and it's edited by Kaz Tanahashi. We focused last time on the devotion to one's work and serving the community. This is what Dogen calls wholehearted practice. When we work in this way, we are Buddha's disciples doing Buddha's work. Even in the most mundane tasks, if we keep our way-seeking mind active, in other words, paying attention to what we're doing and why we're doing it, and to serve the community and leave behind fame and gain, we can feel a sense of purpose and joy. Remember the story about the Tenzo that Dogen met on the ship in China? The Tenzo had walked 12 miles that morning in search of shiitake mushrooms to make a special soup for an upcoming ceremonial meal. Dogen was incredibly impressed by the Tenzo's dedication. They had a conversation that stayed with Dogen. Some months later, the Tenzo retired, having been in the job for a couple of years. And on his way back to his home village, he paid a visit to Dogen, who was now residing at the monastery of his root teacher, Rujing, on Mount Tiantong. The Tenzo wanted to check in and see how Dogen was doing. Obviously, Dogen had made an impression on the Tenzo as well. Dogen writes, "I was deeply touched and overjoyed to welcome him. And during our conversation, I brought up the issues that we had mentioned before on the ship concerning words and phrases and wholehearted engagement of the way. But Tenzo said, people who study words and phrases should know the significance of words and phrases. People dedicated to wholehearted practice need to affirm the significance of engaging the way. Dogen asked, what are words and phrases? The Tenzo said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Dogen then asked, what is wholeheartedly engaging the way? The Tenzo said, in the whole world, it is never hidden. Dogen goes on, although we discussed many topics, I will not record the rest now. For whatever bit I know about words and phrases, or slightly understand about wholeheartedly engaging the way, I am grateful to that Tenzo's kindness. I recounted this conversation to my late teacher, Myozen. He was delighted to hear about it. Later, I saw a verse Shuido wrote for a monk that goes, "One character, three characters, five and seven characters." Having thoroughly investigated the 10,000 things, none have any foundation. At midnight, the white moon sets into the dark ocean. When searching for the black dragon's pearl, you will find they are numerous. Perhaps words and phrases themselves are overrated. They are merely pointers to the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, in other words, the mundane, the everyday, just counting. The taking what comes and the realization that that, the everyday, is all there is. And that is this, and this is that, and everything is included. All that is extraordinary is contained in the ordinary. All that is ordinary is extraordinary. Dorothy had it just about right when she said, "If I ever go looking for my heart's desire again, I won't look any further than my own backyard." She's a great Zen master.
There's a secret there. You just have to tell everybody where that's from.
Oh, does everybody know where that's from? The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy, when she comes back, having gone on this fabulous journey to Oz and discovered what the wizard really is, just kind of a fearful guy, comes to the realization that everything she has, her family, her friends, are right there and have always been there. That's the Dorothy. On the other hand, humans have evolved to model our sense of reality using words and phrases. Words and phrases can be tools to understand the world around us and how we fit in. They can be encouraging to us to continue our practice wholeheartedly and with dedication, so that we can be encouraging to others. Words and phrases can also be weapons. They can arise from fear and resentment to tear down and dismantle, to wear down others until they question their own place in this world. And then the entire community begins to degrade and decay. We can take greater care of our words and phrases. The Noble Eightfold Path, Buddhism 101, if you will, teaches that right speech, one of the aspects of the path, is necessary for addressing the suffering in oneself and in others. Right speech. It is one of the shila, or ethical components, of the Eightfold Path. The Bodhisattva clear mind precepts that are chanted in the Bodhisattva full moon ceremony that we did a few weeks ago, and for Jukai, and during ordination, which is coming up. These include three commitments to words and phrases, to right speech. vowing to be truthful without illusory words, to speak with kindness and not to disparage others, and to practice modestly and modesty by not praising oneself at the expense of others, but rather extolling others instead of oneself. Shepherding are words and phrases to heal rather than to hurt. The Buddha put this together in a short teaching on speech that is in a collection of suttas called the Anguttara Nikaya, or the Numerical Discourses of the Buddha. It's a huge collection, it's about this thick, of the Buddha's teaching of things that have a certain number of components. For example, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Noble Path. There are 8,122 of these numbered suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya. It's pretty amazing. Why are there so many lists? Well, maybe it's because in the absence of a written record, and for training purposes, it was easier for monks at that time to remember a list of items. Anyway, here's a translation of the short sutta on right speech. Bhikkhus, that's a word for monks, bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, and this is the Buddha speaking, possessing five factors, speech is well spoken, not badly spoken. It is blameless and beyond reproach by the wise. What five? One, it is spoken at the right time. Two, what is said is true. Three, it is spoken gently. Four, what is said is beneficial. Five, it is spoken with a mind of goodwill and loving kindness. Possessing these five factors, speech is well spoken, not ill spoken. It is blameless and beyond reproach by the wise. So the first point is to speak at the right time. Even the most beneficial, gentle, and kind words and phrases spoken at the wrong time can be taken the wrong way, and conversely inflame the person receiving the words and drive them to greater heights of afflictive emotional turmoil, which can induce resentment and defensiveness. Knowing when to remain quiet is an impeccable skill that, take my word for it, can save hours of debate, whether in marriage, friendship, or at work. While you'd think keeping quiet would be looked at as a sign of ignorance, it's actually quite the opposite. It takes a strong will to resist telling someone what you think, to resist adding my own take to a conversation. But sometimes the best response is a simple nod, to let the other person know that you are listening and what they are saying is valid. After all, validation is often what is needed the most from someone. The second point, truth is important. Rarely does speaking falsely garner respect and admiration. Yet, truth must be spoken at the right time, with gentleness, and with the intent to be of benefit to the receiver and in the spirit of goodwill, not manipulation or secondary gain for the speaker. If you're like me, I think that many of us feel we are currently living in a time where right speech seems to be so rare. The news is blanketed with people speaking untruths that are easily verifiable as false. People who speak seemingly without any awareness of the harms these untruths cause. And it can be tempting for some people to emulate such behavior. This is even more frustrating to those of us who try to emulate the Buddha and follow the Dharmic teachings. So let's affirm each other's resolve to speak the truth. Let's acknowledge that speaking the truth is seldom easy, especially when it involves reevaluating our own tendencies and behaviors that are self-seeking. Okay, so you may ask, how do I know the truth? What is capital T truth after all? Is there a universal truth? Can there be some truths that are true for some people and some faiths, for example, but not true for other people or other faiths? Well, these are good questions. And you can get caught up in the metaphysical miasma trying to slice and dice various definitions of truth and how they can be coaxed and bent to fit one's own purposes and to support one's own position, no matter how extreme. In Zen, though, I think finding truth is rather easy. You start and end with the precepts. They describe how we can live a truthful life, a life of non-harming, a harmonious life in balance with other people and with the earth. You can also practice truth through the lens of non-self. If desires and thoughts arise that are inherently self-serving, that promote the self at the expense of others, reflecting back again the clear mind precepts, then those thoughts and desires are highly likely to be narrow and confining, reflecting your truth, my truth. Universal truths have unlimited application to countless beings, and so must be inclusive of and for the benefit of all beings. Points 3, 4, and 5, be gentle, be of benefit, be kind. Speaking truth at the right time is best conveyed with kindness and generosity. When someone senses that there is an underlying agenda for what is being said, suspicion and defensiveness will naturally arise. Speaking with a gentle manner and with kindness is a form of nurturing. And people sense that. Dogen refers to the kind and nurturing mind towards the end of the Tenzo Kyokan. This is the parental mind, the mind of mothers and fathers. Parents should have concern for their child's growth and well-being, even at the expense of their own. Dogen says, Parents earnestly consider their child's growth without concern for their own wealth or poverty. They do not care if they are cold or hot, but give their child covering or shade. In parents' thoughtfulness, there is this intensity. People who have aroused this mind comprehend it well. Only people who are familiar with this mind are truly awake to it. Therefore, shouldn't everyone maintain the affection and kindness of nourishing children? Parental mind is selfless mind, and you don't have to be an actual parent to have parental mind. Obviously, Dogen and the rest of the bunch of monks living in the monastery were not parents. When we speak selflessly, it is by nature true, gentle, and caring. There is no space for strong, afflictive emotions to occupy our minds when we speak selflessly and with kindness. It is remarkable that when we can achieve this, people we are speaking with and even those around observing the conversation sense this parental mind, this selflessness, deeply. Now, you may say that your parents were rarely ever like this. Parental mind is a controlling mind, a pain in the neck mind. Well, parents are just like us. They are human. The model that we can use for parental mind is the Buddha. And I have no doubt that even with all of the afflictive emotions that my parents suffered through from time to time, their ultimate model of parental mind was something like the Buddha. Maybe not in name, but in intention. The Buddha also teaches for the benefit of awakening all beings. Teaching without being preachy is the gift of fearlessness. By teaching our coworkers, spouses, children, friends, whomever we speak with, offering a path by example to deeper understanding, we offer the Buddha's gift of teaching. So now we've come full circle. We've seen how the Tenzos, both of the Tenzos in the story that a 20-something-year-old Dogen met in his travels in China, made such an impression on him with their devotion and dedication to their community, which was their entire practice. Their words and phrases centered on mushroom soup and washing rice. So ordinary, so mundane. Because of their wholehearted practice, their everyday words and phrases, their thoughts and actions encompassed the entire universe. Wholehearted practice happens when we make the decision that we matter, the collective we. Our work to benefit others matters. Our words and phrases matter. Through wholehearted practice, negativity, doubt, and fear pale and wither away. We understand that our real selves, our true nature, Buddha nature, is the universal truth. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. reminds us that The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. The arc of the universe is Buddha. The arc of the universe is you. Thank you. So we'll get into groups of three. And if you are new to the groups of three, each person takes an opportunity to talk on a question that I'll give you in just a moment. And we'll do 3 minutes per person. It's kind of a running monologue. So the first person speaks for 3 minutes. Everyone else listens. And the second person then, after a bell is rung, will we do a bell or do we want a self-time? We'll do a bell. Then the second person, 3 minute monologue, third person, 3 minute monologue, and then we'll have a couple of minutes for everyone to kind of share following that. Everything you say is confidential. Please don't repeat it outside of the groups, but if you'd like to, when we get together as a complete group, if you'd like to speak about what was said, but not mentioning who said what, that's good. So the question is, questions are, how do you see yourself engaging in wholehearted practice? How do you see yourself engaging in wholehearted practice? What does that mean? Is it worthwhile? Is it silly? How do you engage in wholehearted practice? If you'd like to talk about something else that's on your mind, that's okay too. So, groups of three, and we'll spend 12 minutes.
So in our group, we discuss about this practice with whole heart. Mm-hmm. So pretty much everyone have the same experience. When we actually focus on what we are doing, let's say when we cook, we will not think about other things. Like for myself, in the past, I always have an earbud with listening to podcast information. I feel that way I can use my time efficiently.
Right.
So when I walk, I always have that. Yeah. But after I practice Zazen and learn the Buddhism, I stop using the earbud. And I feel my life happier.
Yeah.
And I feel like my body lighter somehow because I enjoy when I walk, I enjoy the sky, blue sky. I enjoy the bird sound and the tree, the flower. Mm-hmm. I feel like life is simple and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to get bombarded by this information around me.
Yeah.
So our group, everyone has this kind of feeling. But I do have a couple questions. One is, do you think the whole heart is the same as mindfulness?
You know, it may be a little different. Mindfulness, when I think of mindfulness, it's awareness and concentration, samadhi.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you know, when we're doing things, when we're speaking and we're thinking, we try to be mindful of our actions. Wholeheartedness is probably a different Sanskrit word, would be my guess, and probably different Chinese and Japanese words.
Mm-hmm.
That I would say is like the Tenzo in the Tenzos in the story, where it's like devotion and dedication,
mm-hmm.
Along with mindfulness. So you take mindfulness and then, you know, maybe add devotion and dedication. And those are some of the components of wholeheartedness. I mean, we could probably spend a day or two talking about wholeheartedness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I see, you know, those added dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
in addition to mindfulness. But I think mindfulness is an absolute, you know, on the line of cooking analogies, it's a very important ingredient in the soup. And I think devotion and dedication are also important ingredients.
I think my second question somehow relate to this mind and the heart too.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I read different books about Buddhism, and this always kind of come to my mind that I couldn't figure out, is our mind suffer more or our heart suffer more?
Whether the mind suffers more or the heart suffers more?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the Chinese, and I'm pretty sure the Japanese words for mind and heart are the same. It's heart-mind.
Similar, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, or there is a word that is actually a combination of the two.
Yeah.
And so I kind of like that. Okay. I can understand that because if you really try to dissect mm-hmm. where the mind starts or ends and where the heart picks up, you know, I can't. If you really kind of sit with that, I can't discern, I can't tease them apart. So it makes sense to me that the heart and mind are somehow inseparable.
Yeah.
To my simple mind.
Psychologically, they're related to each other. But if we think about the physical organs, and I feel heart can't think, right? It has to brain to think.
You know, my teacher Norman often talks about, and he's knows a lot more about philosophy than I do. He's, you know, kind of studied Heidegger and all the, you know, a lot of the philosophers. And, you know, in Western philosophy, as I've heard him talk about, there is that big differentiation between the mind and the body. Mm-hmm. The mind is separate. You know, I think, therefore I am, and all of Descartes and all of the other Western philosophical kind of slicing and dicing of mind, whereas in Buddhism, I don't think it is like that.
That's right.
And it's more holistic, I guess one could say. It's more murky and ambiguous. And the heart and mind just seem to work together, be together. So it's like, why would I want to try to separate heart and mind out or body out? Because, you know, as far as we know, in this body, there's consciousness and there's thoughts and there's heart beating and neurons firing. But it's like, try to tease that out, you know, separately from each other. It's impossible. You know, scientists are still trying to figure out, where does consciousness come from?
That's right. That's the fundamental.
And, I just don't think it's ever going to be discernible to humans.
Yeah, that's...
It's definitely like the eye trying to look at itself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Is there somebody online that has a question?
Dave.
On the speaker, so that quite sure how this anecdote aligns with what you just said, but it reminded me of it. You may know the story about when a bunch of Western psychologists and neuroanatomists and so forth went and met with the Dalai Lama and his folks, and were actually trying to integrate Western psychology with Tibetan Buddhism. And at one point, they were putting these brain probes onto the scalps of the monks. And the monks were giggling and laughing about the whole thing. And the scientists thought this was because they just all looked kind of silly. And they said, no, the reason we're laughing is you're putting all the probes in the wrong place. You're putting them on the brain, and they should be on the heart.
Yeah, that's great. Did everybody hear that? So they got a bunch of monks together, and the neuroscientists were putting probes on the brain to, you know, I guess discern, you know, what the meditative state is or something like that. And the monks were giggling. And the neuroscientists, you know, thought that they were giggling because, you know, they thought they looked silly. And they said, no, you're putting the probes in the wrong place. You're putting the probes on, you know, outside of the brain. They should be where the heart is. Mm-hmm. That's a great story. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Dave. Anything else before we chant? Well, I hope you had fun with wholeheartedness. I certainly did.
How would you, let's say, if you don't like to do certain things, how do you put your whole heart to do it?
If you don't like certain things, that's a really good question.
I don't like this to do this.
Yeah.
You have to devote yourself. You know?
Yes. So there is a poem called the Shin Shin Ming that we're going to be studying during the practice period. And the whole like point, if you will, of the poem is not picking and choosing. Because we get into a lot of trouble when we pick and choose. I like this, I don't like that. You could spend every moment of your day picking and choosing everything. And we kind of do, subtly at least, at the very least, if not definitely not so subtly. And the idea is that we don't need to be so picky and choosy. It's not really serving us. If we can, you know, because bad things happen to us. People die, our loved ones die, or leave us. We lose things. We lose our, as we get older, our body changes. I'm more forgetful. If we're less picky, it's like, well, I wish my memory weren't so terrible now. It was much better before. We can accept reality as we perceive it as it is. Things as it is, as Suzuki Roshi used to say. And so, as you continue to practice, at least I have found, I hold on to what I want and what I, you know, my likes and dislikes a little more lightly. And so, if I dislike something less and I like something a little less, you know, because I really want this but I don't want that, and I kind of let that go a little bit, then I can do a whole bunch of things that I maybe used to not like, but I just don't kind of see it quite in that light anymore. Because, I mean, there's so many things, maybe people that we don't like, but when you kind of look at it, whether it's something or some person, you know, what's so bad about that thing? Or what's so bad about that person? You know, no, it's my hang-up about that thing or that person. They're just fine.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N. ONDO.ORG